Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay in the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexities of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my co-host is Misty Hall, and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. So, good evening, Misty. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Good evening to you. How are you?
I'm doing good. Weather's getting warmer in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Spring is in the air. Snow is gone.
Wow.
The only remembrances we have of the snow are some of the big piles of it, like in the shopping centers where they had to plow the whole shopping center out.
Mm-hmm.
But that should be gone within the next 3 months, so I won't have to remember it at all. Which is the way I like it, I think.
Then you can remind me of how hot it is, because it was like super hot here this weekend. I think summer's already in Florida. It was hot.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well,
yeah.
As for people who like the hot weather, Misty, not me. And I know
well,
you don't,
I don't
like it either.
No, I don't. But
no.
I compromise.
Yep, we can't have it all, can we?
No, no. As long as you have a good air conditioner, all will be well.
I think you should be able to have it all, but we don't. But anyway, tonight we have an open forum, so if anybody would like to call in, I'm going to give you the phone number. If you have any questions or any issues you would like us to discuss, you can call in, and here's the number, area code 646-716-4893. And once again, I'll repeat that for you, area code 646-716-4893. And we welcome, and you can also write to me while we're on, you know, the air at bondk@aol.com, and I'll be happy to address any of the issues that you may not want to call in about, but you may want to have us discuss. And I did have one woman who wrote in and asked me if we could discuss something tonight, so I'm going to read her letter to give you an idea. And this woman has been part of our support network for a few years. And she was really very disturbed by this. And she wrote in, and her name's Mary. And she wrote, "Hi, Bonnie. I still continue to read your letters each month. And I am learning to love myself again and learning to be happy with me. I have a question, though. My husband and I have been divorced for 4 years now. And he just broke up with his partner of 4 years because he wanted to apparently express himself more now. He is wearing women's clothes, jewelry, makeup, and wants to be referred to as Diana instead of Michael. What happened to him saying he is gay, bisexual, or what I think? He's losing his mind, so also feel free to share this with any of our support groups. Please tell me the answer to this very, you know, difficult situation. Sincerely, Mary." So, I did tell Mary that I'd be happy to discuss it. And, you know, like I say, a lot of women get very confused because there's so many different areas of sexuality when it comes to the gay arena. And in her particular case, I explained to her that, you know, her husband is either, you know, a sexual identity issue where there are some men, not many, you know, who we think are gay because they identify with gay, who are really transgendered, meaning they're really people living inside the opposite sex body. Have you had much experience with that, Misty?
Excuse me, just started coughing. You know, I have not. I have worked with some women via email with that experience. But in terms of working face-to-face or in person with a lady that has gone through that, no, I haven't. I have not. I know that the women I have worked with via email, it's very difficult and it's very hard for them to understand, just as I'm sure it is the person going through the situation. It's probably hard for them to understand as well. I think a lot of issues arise, and the issues that I've discussed with the women via email is with the children. How, you know, it's really confusing with the children sometimes. And I can imagine, so it has to be very difficult. So
I absolutely agree with that.
System.
And I do want to let women know that there's a whole variety of different sexual issues. Some men are cross-dressers, which is totally different than being transgendered. Some some men just get aroused by wearing certain parts of women's clothes, like it could be women's stockings, women's underwear, you know, their different parts of, you know, some men get really excited by women's shoes. And that's really different than being transgendered, where you really think that you are a woman when you're really a man. And those men who are transgendered, you know, go several routes. Some of them just live as men, and they dress up, they do all the body hair removal, you know, and try to be a woman, you know, to let out their feminine side. Or sometimes they go for, you know, they go for the operation or the surgery of people who are, you know, going to now have a sex change. And some of them are pre-op transsexuals, as they call them, where they'll go through the hormonal treatments and they'll have breasts and they'll remove their facial hair, and yet they're not ready to have that final step to become a woman. And others go ahead, you know, with the whole deal, and they do become women. And I think the whole thing is really very confusing, and it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with gay if you're transgendered, but I don't think it's any less upsetting. Do you think it would be, Misty?
Right, I have to agree with that. Even though I do have limited experience with that, the experience I do have with that, I have to completely agree. It's still something hard for a spouse that identifies as straight. You know, when I say straight, meaning if they're a woman, they identify as being a woman internally, externally, and mentally and physically and all that. I think it's just as confusing when they realize they're married to someone that are wanting to go through those changes. Because
I mean, I can't imagine it. In fact, I don't know if you saw the other day on Oprah, they had a couple who had a little boy who wants to be a little girl. And, you know, did you see that segment?
No, I did not. I missed that.
And he was only maybe 6 years old, and he was insisting that he's a girl. And the parents are very understanding, and they're trying to, you know, go with this flow, even though it's hard for them to understand. But he himself identifies as a girl, and, you know, I guess they're going to take the steps that they need to in his future to make sure that happens for him.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really understand it, I guess. You know, once again, I just have to go back to people are born differently. Just like with gay, we may not exactly understand it, why men are attracted to men or women are attracted to women, but we just have to kind of learn to accept it, that something genetically is different. And as far as, you know, people who are transgendered, you know, I've met people who are transgendered, I've been with people who are transgendered, but it just doesn't mean that I understand how it happens.
Right.
But I think a lot of people lead very tortured lives, and I think it's wonderful that we're living in a much more accepting world today where people can take action and, you know, fulfill who they are, even if it just doesn't seem make a lot of sense to us. But another thing that, you know, a few people have written to me about over the last couple weeks, and I wanted to talk a little bit about this tonight, with sexual addiction. Because a lot of times, you know, women will say, well, I'm married to a guy who's a sex addict. You know, he's not gay. You know, he claims he's just a sex addict and that he'll have sex with women, he'll have sex with men, but he will not say that he's gay. You know, is he gay? So, you know, once again, I'm pretty clear that, you know, people can be a sex addict and they're not necessarily gay, even though they're having sex with men. Because there are those men who will have sex with women, men, animals, anything that they can, you know, find to have sex with. And so I don't really judge anybody on, you know, having to make a label on it. The point is that it's still not something that you want to live with, you know, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't make me feel any better when somebody says sex addict instead of gay. So I, you know, did some research because I told a few people that we would sit and discuss this tonight. And I do want to mention, as I've told you before, Misty, I was married to a sex addict. And it was my straight husband, not my gay husband. You know, prior to my gay marriage to my gay husband, I was married to a straight man who had a sexual addiction. And in the beginning, you know, when I first met him, of course, I was in my early 20s, I guess around 23, 24. And here was this tall, good-looking guy who really loved me. And when we had started having sexual relations, you know, he just wanted to have sex every day. And, you know, I'm going back now to the 1970s. And, you know, I was very flattered, you know, because, you know, what woman wouldn't feel excited that her boyfriend wants to have sex every day?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't just sex, though. It was very similar to what we hear many women saying about their gay husbands. It was mechanical sex. It was just, you know, the action of having sex. And, of course, at that age, you know, I didn't understand. You know, I was just feeling really flattered that he just wanted me every day. And he could have had me twice or three times a day sometimes. But in the beginning of a relationship, that sounds exciting, but after a while, it's not. It's not exciting anymore. And it was a matter that, you know, you don't even want to be with the person because, you know, who can keep up with that kind of action? So, you know, it came to a point where I said to him, you know what, you know, I love you, but I just can't keep doing this every day. So, you know, if you want to do it by yourself, I have no issue with it. And he was very appreciative, and he turned to masturbation, and, you know, he did that at least once or twice a day, you know, by himself. You know, he never said to me, well, come in, or, because it was just a sexual act. But, of course, back then, I didn't understand. You know, I didn't understand about sexual addictions. I didn't understand why it was, and I just knew that I was happy that I didn't have to be part of it all the time. So a lot of times this is not just a, you know, gay thing. This is certainly a straight thing as well. And so I looked up a few different websites that I thought really explained it pretty well. And first of all, I guess, you know, I would try to explain a little bit what sexual addiction is, and then there's some different theories on what causes sexual addiction. So as far as, you know, the definition of a sex addict, and once again, this can happen to someone who's straight or who's gay. I mean, there are people who are just totally straight who are sex addicts. There are people who are totally gay who are sex addicts. And there are people who are sex addicts and they will do it with anybody or anything. So this one article says the term sexual addiction is used to describe the behavior of a person who is unusually intense sex drive or has an obsession with sex. Sex and the thought of sex tend to dominate the sex addict's thinking, making it difficult to work or engage in healthy personal relationships. Sex addicts engage in distorted thinking, often rationalizing and justifying their behavior and blaming others for problems. They generally deny they have a problem and make excuses for their actions. Sexual addiction is also associated with risk-taking. A person with a sex addiction engages in various forms of sexual activity, despite the potential for negative and/or dangerous consequences. In addition to damaging the addict's relationships and interfering with his or her work and social life, a sexual addiction also puts the person at risk for emotional and physical injury. For some people, the sexual addiction progresses to involve illegal activities such as exhibitionism, meaning exposing oneself in public, making obscene phone calls, or molestation. However, it should be noted that sex addicts do not necessarily become sex offenders. So here's a list of behaviors associated with sexual addiction. They include compulsive masturbation. Now, this is what, you know, happened for me with my, you know, straight husband that I had. It was very compulsive. It was every day, and he just had to do it no matter what. You know, there wasn't a day that went by that he wasn't masturbating. Multiple affairs, meaning extramarital affairs. Multiple or anonymous sexual partners and or one-night stands. Consistent use of pornography. Unsafe sex. Phone or computer sex, meaning cyber sex. Prostitution or use of prostitutes. Exhibitionism. Obsessive dating through personal ads. Voyeurism, watching others and or stalking, sexual harassment, molestation, or rape. And it says, generally, a person with a sex addiction gains little satisfaction from the sexual activity and forms no emotional bond with his or her sex partners. In addition, the problem of sex addiction often leads to feelings of guilt and shame. A sex addict also feels a lack of control over the behavior despite the negative consequences, meaning financial, health, social, and emotional. So that was kind of a definition from one article, which I thought, you know, pretty well describes it. Would you say that's pretty good?
Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me. The only thing I would add to that is it did mention the cyber, the internet. I think that is one thing that has really exploded. This population is being labeled as, you know, sex addict. You know, it seems like the internet has just given them such a gateway, such easy access to find, to find sex.
Yeah, in fact, I'm just wondering, you know, how people, you know, used to find it. You know, I guess they went to these adult bookstores, you know, bought magazines. There were always a lot of sex magazines out there. I did have a neighbor who was involved with the phone calls, and he was arrested and put in jail for, you know, I think 10 years for that.
Wow.
He was calling people with obscene, you know, making them do sexual things in their home, claiming that he was watching them, even though he wasn't. And he said that, you know, if they didn't do it, he had a gun and he was going to shoot them. And, I mean, this went on for a number of years until they caught him, because back then, you know, they didn't have the sophisticated phone systems like today. This was about 20 years ago. And, of course, eventually he was arrested and put away. I mean, I think they tried treatment with him and that didn't work. But this article was written by Stephen Donaldson last year. And it says, sexual compulsions don't have to rule your life. And it says you can't break free. And this was his opinion. He claims that in his experience, there are three dynamics that create and maintain a sexual addiction. One is disowned anger, one is shame, and one is hopelessness. It says these have been the major themes in virtually every sexually addicted man I have worked with. When we understand these components, how they work, and how they are related to each other, we can solve the mystery of sexual addictions. I believe with effective therapy, many men can achieve real freedom from these compulsions. On the other hand, when therapists avoid the depression and deep rage that our clients repress into their unconscious minds, no matter how motivated they are or how hard they try, they will never be able to overcome their compulsion to engage in non-intimate and non-relationship sexual behavior. So first he says of disowned anger. Anger is very important to the existence of all animal and human life. When an animal is threatened, it instinctively is compelled to fight and kill if necessary. Likewise, with humans, though we seem to have moved away from violence, anger is the signal that something is wrong and urgently needs to change. It gives us the focus and energy to overcome whatever obstacle stands in our way. Still, human life is infinitely more complicated than that of animals, and anger is not so straightforward for us. Our motives and goals are multi-level and mixed. In addition, there are a lot of us humans on Earth, and we are constantly connecting, cooperating, competing with each other. Anger can be not only an aid to our existence, but a problem for us and people around us. From youth to our dying day, we are taught that we need to control our anger, get over it, and avoid it. Basically, the message is, don't be angry. No wonder we become disconnected from our anger and are not aware of our angry thoughts, feelings, and impulses. And when we become disconnected from our anger, we become disconnected from many other emotions as well. Emotional states are really an all-or-nothing thing. Either we are in contact with our emotions, positive or negative, or we are disconnected from them. When we don't know what we feel, we lose a very important source of information. Without feelings, it's hard to know what we want, what we hate, what we love, and when we're being helped and when we're being violated. Men who have lost contact with their feelings have a hard time knowing who they are and are vulnerable to being taken advantage of by almost anyone who wants to exploit them. In healthy families, parents pay attention and to honor their children's emotions. When a child is angry, the goal of the system is to find out what the anger is about and to help the child with whatever the problem is. The anger is always assumed to be legitimate unless proven otherwise. When children are angry at their parents, this is no surprise to healthy parents, and they do not take it personally. The parents have a good ego strength and assume their job is to take care of the children. Children being angry at parents is considered normal and expected. In less healthy families, children's emotions, especially anger, are considered a problem. In their situations, parents often seek to have their needs met by the children, and so the assumption is not necessarily that parents exist for the sake of the children. Many times, the opposite assumption is made. Difficulty non-tolerating children's anger, especially when the anger is directed at them. In these families, the children's feelings are not paid attention to and not honored. In fact, many families communicate to their children that their emotions are a problem they should be repressed. To cope, children usually do one of two things. Some of them come to believe they are not angry people and they simply do not experience anger. Other children become overly angry and rebellious but carry with themselves a deep sense of guilt and shame about their anger. They feel a deep sense of rejection from their family because of the anger that they experience and act out in the form of outbursts or tantrums. It is important to note that when children emerge from families, they do not have a sense that their family is abnormal in any way. They have no sense that they have been injured or that they are in fact disconnected from their feelings. Even people who come from terribly and overtly abusive families do not see their childhood as abnormal. How does that happen? As children, the need to preserve our parents is so strong that we will distort almost any reality to make them good. Children cannot tolerate the thought that their parents are not good or do not love them. Even as adults, this thought is so frightening that most people would rather suffer debilitating neurosis for their entire lives than face this reality. Still, we cannot escape the reality that many families neglect and abuse their children. For the sexually addicted man, the engagement of some form of sexual stimulation serves as a dual purpose. It gives him the sense of being intimately connected to someone, and it is a discharge of his disowned rage. Addictive sex is non-intimate sex. Non-intimate sex is not making love. In fact, it is the opposite. Humans can express both love and hatred sexually. Sexually addicted men are seldom aware of the hostility associated with their sexual acting out. Only when they reconnect with their feelings do they become fully aware of sex being a discharge of hostile impulses for them. For the men I have worked with, owning their anger is difficult and important work. It is difficult because their anger feels forbidden, unacceptable, and dangerous. They employ strong defenses against experiencing their anger. Owning the legitimate rage is probably the most important component of overcoming a sexual addiction. How do you feel about that part so far, Misty?
I think it's interesting. I think it's a concept that fits, you know, some of the population. I don't think the anger covers all the population. Because my ideas on any type of addiction is, I think people find an addiction, whatever it is, you know, whether it be alcohol, substances, food, sex, whatever it is, I think they're feeling an emptiness, something that's empty. They just keep trying to fill it and fill it and fill it to replace whatever they feel so empty with. So, yes, I think certainly it can identify and explain some of the sexual addictions, but I don't think one theory can possibly explain all of it, if you know what I'm saying, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, that's his first part. Now, his second part is about shame. And I did think this was really interesting. The second component of the sexual addiction is shame. Shame is different from guilt. Guilt is a feeling a good person experiences when he or she has done something wrong. It is a feeling that motivates them to correct their course and do the right thing. It is an impulse to continue to work to be a good person. Although sexually addicted men feel guilt, they are unable to respond to it. Their compulsion continually drives them to act out yet again. Shame is not so much a feeling of having done wrong, but of being wrong. It is a deep sense of inadequacy or badness. When I begin working with sexually addicted men, they are usually very conscious of their shame. In fact, they are often compelled to give me a great deal of data to prove that they are, very bad people. They assume that their shame is because of their sexual addiction, but this is not the case. In reality, their shame existed long before the sexual addiction did, usually originating in their early childhood, perhaps their infancy. shame is actually a defense system that a person uses to ward off anxiety. It is established early on and persists through a person's life. Dysfunctional family systems tend to work assiduously to repress anger in their children. This is because when a child's anger is an expression of autonomy, it says, in effect, I think you are wrong and I object to what you are saying or doing. Then the child is saying to his or her parents, I will not be like you, I will be an individual. While it will set appropriate boundaries around such behavior in a functional family, such autonomy is the goal. In dysfunctional families, however, it is the enemy. Autonomous kids routinely question the family system and the parents. Functional families joyfully welcome this kind of critic and even modify to help or please the children. As families slip down the scale of emotional health, they are less willing to tolerate their children's anger. That's when children develop a shame response to cope with the forbidden and unacceptable anger. They simply turn the anger against themselves. They feel as if it's not their parents that are violating them, rather it is they that are the bad kids. This defense appears to be very powerful in the majority of sexually addicted men that I work with. So what do you think on that part?
I think that's interesting. I think that's very interesting. I think there's quite a bit of validity to that.
On the difference between guilt and shame?
Yeah, excuse me. I think it's a very interesting concept.
Yeah, I mean, once again, I've met different sex addicts and worked with them in the past, but I don't think any of them felt very guilty. I mean, sometimes they felt guilty that they were hurting somebody who they really loved. But, you know, I didn't see, like, a great amount of, you know, guilt with going with their actions. But The third component that he talks about is hopelessness. The third component, hopelessness, is pretty straightforward and fully conscious. Men who have suffered from a sexual compulsion for any length of time develop a deep sense of hopelessness. Their repeated attempts to repress their sexual urges, followed by repeated failure, is so powerfully depressing that they find little reason to resist. They are not only hopeless about overcoming their sexual addiction, but despair about ever feeling better in life. I have never met a sexually addicted man that did not have other problems in life. These men are usually very unhappy about any number of things. They may be in bad marriages or working for people who mistreat them. They may be complying with their parents or in-laws in a way that is very unsatisfying to them. These men have usually adapted a passive response to the world, a sort of learned helplessness. They feel not only hopeless about being able to change their sexual behavior, but about changing their lives so they are able to really enjoy life. In fact, most of them do not even really believe that they have a right to enjoy life. They have lived under the thumb of someone all their lives, and their shame tells them that this is what they deserve. Sexual addictions are often mistakenly attributed to bad habits, excessive libido, poor self-discipline, or bad character. In reality, sexual addictions are a coping mechanism a man develops early in life. The defense mechanism, sexual addiction, may not manifest itself overtly in sexual symptoms until later in life, but the components of the system are formed early. These components include repression of anger, shame, which has turned anger against the self in the form of self-hatred, and a complaint and passive response to interpersonal pressure and vulnerability to depression. And it says that the good news is that properly understood and with the right resources, sexual addictions can be effectively treated. Men can and do achieve real freedom from their sexual compulsions and gain control of their lives. So that's what this article said. I think it said a lot of interesting facts. And I think a lot of times we have discussions with our women that their husbands do have a kind of sexual addiction as far as their incessant need to be on the computers with the pornography, picking up numerous men, truck stops, or places that, you know, are unknown to us. You know, but anywhere in the world where they can find a man, and a lot of times just have a sexual act without any kind of meaning. So I guess some of this does apply, especially the part about feeling the helplessness and hopelessness. Because I think that, you know, we're talking here about how they feel really, you know, repressed because in the hopelessness because they're not happy in their lives and because that, you know, they feel like a failure. A lot of these men who try to be a husband, you know, to their straight wives are having failures with that. So I think that, you know, beyond being gay, you know, this could lead to a sexual addiction for gay men. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting concept, but I also think with, excuse me, with some of the gay husbands that we've worked with through our straight wives, I think it's interesting to also note that sometimes I think this sexual addiction results as or comes from, you know, the gay husband trying to find a sexual partner and not really establish a bond with that person, you know, there's sort of a thrill component to that sometimes. So I think that thrill associated with finding a sexual partner can also lead to somewhat of a something that appears to be similar to sexual addiction.
Yeah, see, I'm just not quite sure because, you know, on the whole gay issue with gay men, as we had those wonderful men who appeared with us last week, and certainly from talking with so many, you know, other men that I've worked with over the years, many of them really do feel repressed in their sexuality as far as their homosexuality. And when they're finally able to come out or come to terms with it, you know, so as they will all tell me, they use this phrase, they're like kids in a candy store. It's like now they have all these choices, you know, to make up for everything they feel they missed when they were younger. And they feel they've given up, you know, 10, 20, 30 years of their life where, you know, they wanted to be out there meeting men and having relationships. And now, you know, but they suppressed it all these years. And now all of a sudden they're out there. So they become promiscuous or they're just looking, you know, for love in all the wrong places. And I'm not sure how much they're really looking for love in the beginning. You know, I think they're just looking to be loved or to have some kind of sexual, you know, wonderful experience that could turn to love. But I think that, you know, a lot of times, you know, I look at the gay bars. And have you ever been to a gay bar, Mindy? Misty?
Yes, I have. It's very interesting.
And, I mean, in Florida?
No. Actually, in Lexington, Kentucky, there's several. So I've been, I went there with some friends a couple of times to some of the different ones.
Right, and I think a lot of times, you know, when men first come out, this is a local hangout where they go. And, you know, I know that when I was first getting involved with the gay community, nearly, I hate to say this number, like nearly 30 years ago or 28 years ago, and I was going out, so I started my support group and I tried to bring political awareness to hold the fact about straight gay marriages. And I started writing for a local news, gay newspaper here, a column called Straight Talk. And then I did some feature articles for them as well, interviewing gay men on different issues. And, you know, so I had some experience in the gay bars where I never felt at home or comfortable. It was much too soon, you know, after my marriage, but, you know, I try to be mature and adult about it. But, you know, I went to the gay bars, and this was like a very big focus, you know, on, you know, I thought this was the gay community. And for many people when they're first coming out, not knowing where to go or what to do. A lot of gay men do, you know, go over to the gay bars, and I think that that's where they start, you know, their experiences in there because, you know, it's a likely place where you're going to meet people who want to meet you and go home with you and have sex with you. I mean, that's what the bar scene's about. As a man feels more comfortable with his sexuality, you know, he doesn't have the need to do that anymore. He can find a good relationship, you know, meet a nice man and have, you know, a quote-unquote normal type of relationship, you know, not having to run to the bars. But no doubt, you know, when I was meeting a lot of these guys in the bars, it was like the running joke was that if you're with a guy for a week, that's like a long-term relationship. And I think in the beginning, very beginning of gay relationships, that's so because, you know, they don't last long. People are in there looking for hookups and pickups and, you know, to find out who they are and really to try to make up for the sex that they've missed. I think that changes as time goes on, I think, you know, that certainly they move away from that scene and hopefully find a partner that they're comfortable with. And, you know, Once again, I haven't met a lot of gay couples, but I certainly do know some who have long-term relationships that are good, solid relationships. You know, so I know that certainly it does happen. You may not hear about it as much because we're not part of the gay community per se. And we're used to seeing all the things that other people see on television and in the movies, which is, you know, certainly a different kind of note of what most people are once they're part of, you know, when they're gay. You know, they don't have to feel that they're part of that part of the community. But I think that a lot of us are confused because, you know, women who see their husbands on the computer every single night for hours a night, and they know they're doing something as far as meeting guys or talking to guys or having, you know, cyber sex on, you know, with other guys, and it's like an ongoing thing. It just takes over their life. So I don't know if that's considered an addiction in the sense that, you know, they hadn't suppressed who they were all these years. Would they be like that now? Or is it the fact that they had to suppress themselves all these years or hide from who they were, that now they're like those kids in the candy shop and they're just so happy they can, you know, find some happiness in whatever they enjoy doing? And what do you think, Misty?
Wow. I think it's interesting.
I'm not too far away from what I'm trying to say.
Well, what comes to my mind is, you know, which comes first, the chicken or the egg, you know? I don't know. I certainly follow what you're saying. I don't know which one, you know, if it's the suppression of it or is it the acting on it, you know, what causes it. I don't know. But what I do know, and I'm sure you can agree with this, working with women that are involved with a partner that is, a sexual addict is just so difficult, very difficult. And, I mean, I'm like you, you know, it's whether they're gay, whether they're straight, whatever it is they proclaim to be, it's something very, very difficult to live with. And it's something that I think any relationship will be injured from, you know, repeatedly having a partner acting out sexually outside the relationship. So,
no, I
you know,
totally agree. And if
yeah,
you
it's
have,
just something hard to deal with.
And if any of you out there who are listening now would like to call in and share your thoughts on that, we're at area code 646-716-4893 in case you have any questions or you've experienced sexual addictions with your own husbands. I mean, we do have women who tell us that their husbands are totally addicted with sex, totally addicted to the computer, porn, you know, they find a million different things, videos, magazines, you know, it becomes just like an obsession. But getting back to what you were saying, Misty, is that, you know, for the reasons why people develop addictions in general is because they find that something is missing in their own lives. Also, another part of this, you know, that really is confusing because, you know, there's been different schools of thought on this whole strand of addiction versus obsessive-compulsive behavior, that some people, you know, just have obsessive-compulsive behavior, which is different than having an addiction. I think a lot of the reasons why people have it, you know, are similar, but not necessarily always the same. I know people with obsessive-compulsive behavior, as my, you know, husband, my straight husband had that as well and was diagnosed with it. He came from a very rigid life, and a lot of times people, you know, I studied obsessive-compulsive behavior, you know, usually they'll find that there's, you know, like a very rigid person in the family, for instance. I think we've all dealt with people who like to keep things immaculately clean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the time they're born, you know, their parents are constantly, you can't mess this up, you can't mess that up. And I don't mean about having things scattered here or there. I mean, you know, every day is a new day to keep things really clean. And their whole life is obsessed with, you know, cleaning. And they can't, you know, move an inch anywhere and leave anything. So I think that a lot of that is learned behavior in a sense and, you know, enters into their adulthood. And with obsessive-compulsive behavior, I mean, there's all different kinds of, you know, obsessive-compulsive behaviors, whether it's washing your hands 20 times a day, having to stay into a shower, you know, for an hour and a half. I mean, I know people with obsessive behaviors. For instance, I know one woman who has children, and, well, here's an example. You know, when she buys canned goods, she has to line them up in her closet according to alphabetical order. And I know that sounds like hilarious, but it's not when you have to be so obsessed to keep doing that. And her house has to be immaculate at all times. If her children spill anything on their clothes, you know, she goes berserk. You know, they can't even let their faces get messed up. You know, she has this thing about keeping clean and keeping things in order. And, you know, there are people who go to the extreme other, you know, end of it as far as, you know, you've seen a lot of things on television lately about people who are hoarders, you know,
mm-hmm.
who have to keep everything they have and they can't let go of anything. And you can't walk into their houses. You know, it's impossible. You know, they won't throw out one thing. And that's another form of obsessive-compulsive behavior on the other end, in the other spectrum. So, once again, I'm not sure how much of this has to do with feeling emptiness inside or feeling hopelessness or helplessness, but these behaviors, you know, certainly do manifest themselves in a lot of our marriages. And once again, I'm not quite sure. A lot of times if men really are sexual addicts or they're just reacting, you know, I don't think that any normal, healthy, sexual person wants to just have sex all the time where it overtakes their lives. Do you?
No, I don't think it's a healthy balance. I think, in order, you know, sex needs to be healthy. And to, you know, to be incorporated into a marriage or relationship, it needs to be healthy. And when, you know, it's just something that becomes obsessive, and regardless, you will, you know, either step outside the relationship, take risky behaviors and do things of that sort, it becomes very unhealthy. Unhealthy, you know, it can become unhealthy mentally and also unhealthy physically. You know, if you're involved in high-risk situations, possibly catch some type of disease, bring home to your partner and things like that, I don't think that's healthy at all.
No. And then, you know, once again, not having any kind of guilt or remorse, you know, you just keep repeating it over and over. And I think that's why, you know, a number of our women have sexually transmitted diseases because
mm-hmm.
they have husbands who really know the difference between how to have safe sex and not, and they just take those chances anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that the least you could do if you're going to go outside your marriage is at least make sure that the person who's in your home is going to be protected against having a sexually transmitted disease. And to me, it's, you know, it makes me really angry when I have to find out that women have HIV, AIDS, or gonorrhea, or, you know, any kind of sexually transmitted disease
mm-hmm.
from their husbands who weren't considerate enough, you know, when they were out there. So do you think that's part of a sexual addiction, too?
I think it can be if you're involved in high-risk behavior. It doesn't matter, you know, where you don't take precaution. It's just you have to have the sexual act. You don't care where it's coming from. You don't care to know the background of the person. And it doesn't even matter whether or not you use protection. I think being involved in that type of high-risk situation frequently, I think it poses great danger to yourself, to your partner, and to the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that anytime something overtakes your life, you know, we had a case here in Philadelphia where a man actually went and murdered his wife. And this was a straight man because he was madly in love with, you know, a girl that he met, one of the pole girls at a bar. And, you know, his wife just became totally obsessed with her. And he spent tens of thousands of dollars. And I guess his wife started holding him accountable for where all the missing money was. And he decided he had to kill her because, you know, she was going to get in the way between him and the pole girl. And
what?
You know, the pole girl wasn't like a real relationship. This is just a fantasy relationship in his mind. But, you know, this is why I tell women, you know, moving away from the gay issue for a moment, that, you know, if you're in a relationship and you don't fix yourself after one of these relationships, you are just
mm-hmm.
so bound to find yourself back in another one. And
mm-hmm.
I think with sexual addiction, what it tells us is that it's certainly not confined to gay men. There are plenty of straight men who are sex addicts, and there are a lot of straight men who have lots of weird sexual kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, I wrote a whole book about that called Man Readers, A Woman's Guide to Dysfunctional Men, and I really studied men for a long time, and I really did a lot of research about all kinds of men, you know, having nothing to do with gay. I mean, these are straight men who all kind of had all kinds of sexual differences or deviances. You know, you can call it whatever you want to call it. But, you know, it wasn't something that I would ever want to live with in any kind of situation, including, you know, men who became, you know, once again, the cross-dressers And that's not making a judgment call on anyone. If a man wants to dress up or gets stimulated by, you know, women's clothing, it just comes down to, you know, do I want to live with this? And a lot of these men are definitely not honest with their wives, you know, before they marry them. And then there are men who are into other kinds of fetishes, like shoe fetishes, you know, stocking fetishes, I mean, feet fetishes, you know, all kinds of fetishes. And then there are men who are into, you know, anything like animals. You know, you'd be really shocked to see how many straight men out there have been involved with animals. And I'm not talking about having, you know, a relationship with one in the same sense, although there are men who different kinds of, you know, men who are into bestiality. And there are those men who really do have an emotional relationship with their animal. As repulsive as that may sound or ridiculous as it may sound, they really do. They're not the majority. The majority of men who have sex with animals is just a sexual act. And but once again, there's so many men out there with all these kinds of deviances. And you say to women, if you're not healthy yourselves, you know how easy it is to just meet someone who's not healthy also. And I think that's the whole key, to try to meet somebody who doesn't have all this kind of emotional baggage or sexual hang-ups. And you can't do it as long as you yourself aren't feeling, you know, strong and ready to meet, you know, the right man. Do you agree with that?
I completely agree with that. You know, if you walk into a relationship really broken and not repaired from the previous relationship, I just think you're so much more apt to accept and look over red flags and warnings. You're so more susceptible to just settle for what is there, accept it, and just look over things that you should not be looking over. And oftentimes, you repeat very similar patterns. Like, for example, if you think, okay, well, I've got this over with, I've, you know, I'm not going to marry or be with someone gay again. Well, you know what, you may find a straight partner, but, you know, you may find a whole new set of issues that are very similar to the core issues of the relationship before.
Not only that, but how many women do we have coming to us who tell us that this is their second marriage and mm-hmm. they were in an abusive marriage, physically or emotionally abusive marriage the first time, and now they find themselves in this marriage?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's any accident. Once again, it's a matter of not feeling the strength in yourself, you know, to have the desires and wishes that you want as a woman, that you're willing to settle for less than what you deserve in a relationship.
Exactly.
And all the time I get letters from women every single day. And, you know, I hope I don't hurt anyone's feelings by saying this, but, you know, I have to say it as it is, as my women know. You know, I don't try to move around about the reality of it. Mm. But it's a matter that, you know, these women write that, you know, they love these men, they can't live without these men. You know, they try to make all kinds of bargains, you know, to be with these men. What can I live with? What can I stand? You know, that we can be, you know, best of friends and still live together. There must be a way. You know, I get so many letters of there must be a way. Why are you telling me no? You know, I love this guy. And I think that, you know, it's so hard because a lot of these guys, you know, when you have someone who is violent against you, then it's automatically, you know there's a problem. But, you know, when you have a great guy and it turns out that he's gay, you know, you don't want to have to give up that relationship because this kind of problem came into it. And even today I had a young lady, you know, who may be listening now, who wrote to me several different times, and she said to me, you know, he's bisexual. Does that mean that can he learn to just love me enough not to want a man? And I said to her, no, he can't. You know, he's telling you up front that he's bisexual. He is saying to you that he could love you enough not to want a man. But the fact is, he's already had relationships with men. He's attracted to men. It doesn't mean that he's never going to have one again. I mean, you know, he may love you with all his heart, but he's going to still have that attraction and that need to be with a man. And, you know, so many times people write to me, Misty, and they say to me, well, I'm going to be the one that writes back mm-hmm. to you. You know, I'm going to be the success case. Or, you know, finally, then they finally write back a year later, well, maybe it wasn't what I thought, but, you know, we are coping, we are struggling, we're making new kinds of arrangements, new kinds of agreements, and we're still hoping it can work. And then another year or two goes by, and then they say, okay, it didn't work, you were right. But the point is that I'm not here to tell you that you're right, you know, that I'm right, because, you know, that's not what this is about. It's about trying to protect you against finding relationships that aren't, you know, that you're not, aren't worthy of being in your life. And if you don't really work to change yourself, you're going to keep finding these same kind of guys, because there's so many guys out there looking for vulnerable women. You know, because that way they don't have to make any changes. They can be who they are. And they know it's just a matter of time that you're going to accept them for what they are, because you're going to be too weak to leave them.
Exactly.
Do you find that same thing?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it happens every day. And if you jump in, if you, you know, once you're out of a relationship and you find yourself wanting to jump right back into another serious relationship, chances are it's not going to work. Someone's going to get really hurt. Or you're just going to keep settling and putting up with more stuff. It's going to be very things similar to the relationship you just jumped out of. It's very concerning to me when I work with anyone, especially a straight wife, and she's told, but this person's different. This person's everything I want, everything I need. And, you know, of course, I can't say, well, you know, I told you so a year later or whatever, but usually that's the way it happens. They come back, wow, this person was controlling. This person was, you know, just like my ex-husband or things like that. And it's, you know, you have to give yourself time to heal. People, I think the American culture, we're into a quick fix. You know, take one pill, it'll work. Take two pills, it'll work really fast. And you don't have to do anything but just wait on the pill to work. So I think we really have fallen into that type of mentality to where, you know, with healing, we don't realize it's grunt work almost. I mean, it's not easy. You got to go through a lot of things. You have to process a lot of things. You can take medication, but, you know, it's just going to suppress some of those feelings. And, you know, I say, you know, if you're able, and, of course, some people do need medication. I'm not saying I'm absolutely against it, but if you don't take it and just push through it. Work through things. You'll give yourself time to heal. Have to give yourself time to heal. I think that's the most important thing.
And you know what? I'm really in agree with everything you say. And I can even understand if you have to take medication while you're healing, you know, because some people are just so overwhelmed by this tragedy. But
exactly.
It gets me so upset when people have to take medication to stay in a marriage. You know, and I can't talk about that enough, because it just really makes me ill that people have to alter their state of mind to stay in a marriage. Like, what is wrong with that picture? You know, what is wrong with the picture that you can't be who you are? Not only can't you be who you are, but now you have to be somebody else to zombie yourself out or to suppress your feelings in order to exist in a marriage.
You know, and I was I have to admit, I did that, and it was terrible. I remember going to the doctor. The marriage was awful. It was just so crumbled and so broken. He refused to go to any type of counseling or therapy because, of course, there was nothing wrong with him. I need to go because there was something wrong with me. So I went, and I remember getting a prescription for an antidepressant. And I think, I think I may have taken three or four. I can't remember. It was less than a week, and I thought, oh, my goodness, what am I doing? And I quit. I thought, I've got to find a way out of this situation. You know, it took me a while. I didn't do it immediately. And I'm not saying some people don't need medication, because you're right, it can be such a traumatic event, such trauma can come from these types of marriages that you know, some people need a little bit of help to get the edge off. I understand that. But I was, like, thinking, this is not for me. I'm not going to chemically, medically alter myself to conform to everything he wants me to do, be, or say.
And I think that's beautifully put, Misty. That's really what it comes down to, that you have to now become, you know, like one of the Stepford wives, you know, in order to survive in a marriage. I mean, I tell people this is not what marriage is about. Has nothing to do with marriage. And this is kind of like that same kind of obsessive compulsive behavior, you know, that people exhibit in different ways. And I think that, you know, codependency, you know, will certainly make that one of our topics in the next week or two coming up, that so many people have codependent behavior that, you know, I say to the women, I say, you know, where do you see yourself? Is this how you want to spend the next 10 years of your life? How about the next 5 years? No, I'm not happy. No, I'm miserable. And I'll say, well, what can you do to resolve that? I don't know, but I can't leave. You know, mm-hmm. Why can't you leave? Because I can't. Because why? Because I just can't. I can't be, you know, I can't be on my own. And, you know, a lot of times that's what it comes down to. It's like very codependent behavior. And they'd rather be miserable, crying, upset. And I really can't help people in that situation. You know, I tell them, well, listen, if you want to stay in your marriage, there are groups that work with that, like the Straight Spouse Network. Which reminds me, in April, my good friend Carol Silverman, and who's wonderfully, who's a good friend to all of us, you know, she's going to be our guest on the show from the Straight Spouse Network. But the Straight Spouse Network, you know, at least they have a group of people who want to stay together, which, you know, is a group that I won't work with. But at least, you know, somebody's working with them as they're struggling through their lives each day and how to cope in a marriage where you have a gay husband. And once again, what's the quality of life for both these people? I mean, you know, is it a quality of life to be in a marriage where you really don't belong? And it's not a matter, well, I love our children. I mean, is this the right, you know, message you want to give to children? That it's okay to live in a marriage where you don't have intimacy, where you don't have passion, where you don't have sex? I mean, this is the message that we give to children when we stay in marriages, you know, that are like this. And then mm-hmm. once again, we always go back to the children feeling guilty that they believe it's their fault the parents are staying together because, you know, if the parents split up, then they're splitting up the family, or they're staying together for the sake of the children, but both parents aren't happy. You know, there's just it's just like dancing in your circle of crazy that you always talk about, Misty. Mm-hmm. People get stuck in that circle, and they just keep dancing around it because they can't get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I do. It's, you know, once that circle of crazy gets so chaotic, more circles just start spinning off of it. Like, you know, it's like before you know it, you're involved in a three-ring circus. You don't know what to be, what to believe. And most importantly, you lose who you are. When you lose who you are, you know, what's it worth to continue in a relationship when you don't even know who you are, when you're not respected for who you are? It's just no way to live. And the reason I say that, and it sounds very judgmental, but the reason I say that, I'm reflecting on my own past. Because I was one of those people that said, oh, I'm going to make this work with my now ex-husband. And it couldn't. It just blew up in my face every day. I continually lost pieces of who I was.
And it's because you're not living an authentic life. And that's mm-hmm. why I tell everybody, life was never meant to be this complicated. You know, marriages aren't supposed to be like this. They're supposed to be the best relationship between two people who are soulmates, who, you know, have common grounds, who are working in the same direction. And you can be married to the most wonderful gay man in the world because there are certainly wonderful gay husbands. But the bottom line is they're gay and they don't belong married to you. You know, and if they married you with all the best of intentions and they were hoping that things could work out, but they can't be who they're not, and it's just a marriage that's not meant to be. It's a mismarriage, meaning it's a mistake, and you can fix it, and you can still be good friends and still raise your children together and still co-parent, but it's really not a quality of life. So in the next couple of weeks ahead, we're going to be working on some of these issues. Next week, we're going to do a special show on self-esteem and building yourself up and giving you some really good concrete tips on how you can start doing that. I think that, you know, what I tell women all the time also, Misty, is that self-esteem is an issue I have to work on every single day of my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm certainly ahead of where I was 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, but I'm certainly not where I need to be. And, you know, every day I have to do things to reinforce, you know, feeling good about myself. And I think that a lot of our women just don't even know where to begin with that. So
mm-hmm.
Misty and I will be giving you some really good tips on how to start rebuilding your self-esteem. And any other things that come your way, feel free to write to me at bondk@aol.com. Next week also, one of the things I wanted to do is now that I've, you know, updated my website, I wanted to go through my new list of characteristics to look for in the gay husband on my gay husband checklist, because I've added a lot of things, and Misty and I will be discussing them also. So, Misty, our hour has flown by.
It
and
has.
I'm really proud of you for staying awake.
Thank
Misty
you.
Misty has to be up at 5 in the morning and on the road for her
yes.
job.
Comes so early.
I know. It's really terrible. You know, we've been doing the show all this time, and you had a later job. Now you have an earlier one.
I know.
You're still rising to the occasion. I really appreciate it, because I couldn't do it without you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Misty, I hope you have a wonderful week.
You too. Thanks.
And what are you going to say to everybody?
Good night and love to all.
Good night and love to all of you, and we'll be back next Sunday night. Good night.
Good night.